This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes.
Today's episode of The Sherman Show is recorded on Thursday, March 24th, 2022. All right, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of The Sherman Show. I am Jeff Sherman, and I'm here with my co-host, Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
And Sam is virtual, but today I have a live guest with me. I have none other than Dr. Robert Funk. We're coming to you live from Santiago, Chile. Welcome, Dr. Funk.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
this is great.
Yeah, so people that don't know Dr. Funk, he's a political analyst at Global Source Partners. He is also an assistant professor of political science at the University of Chile and a partner in Andes Risk Group. I'm probably butchering the Espanol, but I'm doing my best. But he consults on Latin American political risk, and I think you're relatively busy these days.
There's a lot of risk going on.
There's a lot of risk. And so also, you know, you have a PhD in government from the London School of Economics. So you kind of tie these things together with political risk and financial markets. And we thought our listeners would really enjoy getting perspective from someone with literally their boots on the ground.
Right.
Yes. Okay. So maybe give us a little bit of background, like how you became a political analyst and really, you know, what you do in the consultancy role, and how you apply that thinking to financial markets.
So I guess I have a fairly untraditional career trajectory for academia, because academia tends to be all-encompassing, and people sort of publish papers and journals that few people read. And what happened with me was, as soon as I started my PhD at the LSE at that time had, still has it, a consulting company, which basically offered the services of academics at the LSE. And I got involved in a project that they had with a financial analysis firm in New York. And we used to provide political risk analysis for Latin America. And so right from the beginning, I started doing Chile, which was the topic of my PhD. And so from the beginning of my academic career, I always had a foot in consulting. And then when I moved down to Chile almost 20 years ago, I continued with that work. And eventually, with a few partners, we set up our own consulting company and continued with all of that. And of course, in recent years, with things that have been going on in Chile, certainly since the protest of 2019, but even before that, there's been renewed interest. When I started doing my PhD, my supervisor, my thesis supervisor said, "Why are you studying Chile? It's so boring." and now it's unfortunately much less boring, but that's good for business. And so I always keep an eye on how political events in Chile obviously affect foreign investment, how it affects Chile's kind of position in the world and in Latin America with regards to how the rest of the world sees us. You know, they used to see us as a place that was boring and a fairly safe investment, a country that was kind of emerging market, but not really.
But really, really more developed of the emerging world. Developed.
And now we kind of woke up one morning and said, hey, maybe we are actually an emerging market. So all of that's interesting for my line of work, and it's been busy, and I find it much more rewarding actually than just being sort of an academic that writes papers and journals.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting too you mentioned that, because I was down here maybe 4 or 5 years ago and having conversations with some prospects, which are now clients, and when we were talking about it, I said, you know, I read the newspaper in the U.S. We look like the emerging economy of the way our headlines are reading, and Chile seems so stable. Why don't you walk our listeners through the protest of 2019, what it was really about, and what it's done to kind of evolve some of the thinking of the government? And I want to get deeper into the constitution rewrites and things like that, but maybe you can give the background on that.
Well, you know, Chile was always seen as a country that had a particularly successful democratic transition. Many countries in Latin America had democratic transitions in the 1990s, And Chile had a transition that was, that in the literature was called a negotiated or pact transition. And there's debate in the literature about whether that was actually true or not, but that's what we, how we approach things. And what that meant was that there was a kind of, there was a series of written and unwritten rules that kind of guided Chilean politics over the last 30 years since the democratic transition. And one of those, and part of that package, was the fact that we were still operating under a constitution that was imposed on the country by the dictatorship, by General Pinochet in 1980. It had undergone hundreds of amendments. So in effect, it wasn't really the same constitution, but kind of the in the public imagination, it was Pinochet's constitution. Together with that—
When you say the public, you're talking about the local Chileans.
Right.
Yes, okay.
Around 2006, we started getting, there's a tradition in Chile of student protests. And around 2006, we got something slightly different, which was high school students started protesting. Those high school students protest eventually went into university. And by about 2011, we have massive student movement protesting the quality of higher education, the cost of higher education, and so on. And that movement grew and began and kind of morphed into an overall demand for political change, for a new constitution. And that was the second line. The third kind of dimension of all of this was that in October of 2019, they announced an increase on subway fares of basically five cents.
Yeah.
And for several weeks, students were protesting this increase in subway fares. And by the evening.
And this isn't really like a third world emerging economy, like 5 cents, it wasn't like a massive increase.
It wasn't a massive increase.
But it is an increase.
But it was kind of symbolic of how tone deaf the government was to what people were feeling in terms of the cost of living. And so by the evening of October 18th of 2019, these protests were getting out of hand, students jumping over turnstiles, people jumping up and down in subway trains and so on. And the government opted to close the subway stations.
I think of the movie The Warriors. I don't know if you're familiar with that, right? Yeah. Like that's kind of the sentiment, really, right?
I mean, it looked a lot like that. You know, on the one hand, you could consider it a peaceful protest, but it was really interrupting the everyday flow of traffic and so on. And someone was going to get hurt. The government closed the subway stations, and by that evening, the protests grew. We started getting some subway stations getting put on fire. And the thing really got out of control over that weekend, such that the president declared a state of emergency, said Chile was at war against an invisible enemy. Apparently, he was getting information, which was never really confirmed, that this was being organized out of Venezuela or whatever. And the truth was, it was just massive popular discontent. And the government never really got their hands around it. They tried to offer some increases in transfers and bonuses and things like that. But really, the thing grew and grew and grew. Things got more violent. Supermarkets were looted and torched. Downtown really became almost like a war zone in the kind of ritzier parts of Santiago where we find ourselves now. The tanks were on the street to try to control the situation. It was kind of scary.
Well, it's funny you say ritzier because we actually are at the Ritz-Carlton right now. So there's a good pun in
just
there.
Just down the street from here, we have tanks on the street. And of course, that in Chile brings back pretty awful memories.
Yeah.
So by the following Friday, you started having massive protests, middle-class people, mothers, families, marching in the central square of Santiago in Plaza Italia. 1.5 million people turned out and protesting and saying, we are not at war, and demanding a series of different things, including a new constitution. A month later, when things were not any more calm, the only way that President Piñera could think of to kind of stop this was to ask his ministers to negotiate and sit down with parliament and come to some sort of political agreement. And the political agreement was a new constitution. And so they agreed that there would be a referendum on whether Chileans wanted a new constitution. And if so, then they would set up what we're going through now, which is a constitutional process.
Yeah. So as you think through that, what are the ramifications of this, of redrafting? And you know, you have a new president now as well. How does that process work? I mean, a lot of our American folks would say, how do you rewrite a constitution, right?
Well, it's not uncommon. You know, the American experience is actually the outlier. Right. It's not normal to have a constitution that lasts 200 years. And the reason the American constitution has lasted 200 years is that it's very short and it's very general. Kind of, it's a declaration of principles. It doesn't really go into detail. The Latin American tradition is different. Latin American tradition constitutions tend to be long and detailed, and therefore, after 10 or 20 or 50 years, they kind of become obsolete. And especially a constitution written under dictatorship, which was very much written as a Cold War document, right? For example, the original Pinochet constitution outlawed the Communist Party because it was written in the context of the Cold War.
Yep.
So that was later changed, but that gives you an idea of what was going on.
So it's very contemporaneous then too. It's not thinking long term. Addressing what are the societal concerns at the
time. I'm afraid is we're making the same mistake now. So that's why it's not unusual for countries. Colombia went through it. Brazil went through it. Often countries go through constitutional conventions when after a process of democratization. Now, you could argue in a way that's what we're going through, right? Where after the protests, which I happen to consider were basically a kind of revolution, mm-hmm. it became obvious that we had a need to redesign the political system because the kinds of demands that were being made were structural, right? It wasn't just, we want better healthcare. They were asking for that, or we want better education. But it was the only way that the country could move forward on these demands was to change the structural dynamics, the political dynamics of how we are run. Now, again, things have kind of gone off the rails, I feel, but that's the intention.
That's the intention. So go ahead, Sam.
I was going to add on to the constitutional convention here. And it just seems like many of the polls that have been taken recently have just point to a growing disappointment regarding the job of the convention, the job that the convention has done so far. Right. With, I think, the most recent poll, nearly 60% believe that the convention's work is below expectations. So what are some of the challenges there in meeting these expectations? What are the expectations? I think you started to indicate a few there, but what are some of the challenges that they're facing right now?
So when we had the referendum, I mentioned that the process set up a referendum. We had the referendum and 80% of voters voted in favor of a constitutional process. And the next step was to elect the convention members. 155 convention members were elected, except of those 155, 17 were reserved seats for indigenous groups. So the surprise was, and the other aspect of the process that was really important was that every article that is approved needs to be approved by 2/3 of the convention. And that was seen as a kind of guarantee that nothing too crazy would go into the constitution, because historically in Chile, the right, which is kind of more conservative, easily gets 1/3 of the vote, if not more, maybe 40%. And the surprise was that they didn't. And so we have a convention that's basically dominated by the center left and the far left. And then we have independents who tend to lean left, and the indigenous groups who have their own interests. And so what's developed is that the convention is really being dominated. I was quoted in The Economist a few months ago where I said, Chile is putting together the world's first woke constitution because it's really dominated by concepts which are really important: environmental protection, indigenous rights, feminism, gender equality, and so on. But that's dominating everything. So rather than kind of thinking what's the best political system that guarantees stability, they're constantly thinking about representation.
Okay.
Constantly thinking and making sure that, and in fact, what's already in the proposed text, which will again is going to be put to referendum at the end of the process, but what's already in the proposed text is that essentially everything that is done in Chile from the state will need to be taken into consideration: indigenous considerations, feminist considerations, environmental consideration. And that last point is going to be something that is probably going to really affect investment at some point.
Yeah, I want to get to that. But before we do, let's talk about the new president, right? And so this was, you know, a big switch too, right, to kind of more extreme left wing, right, with Boric, right? Maybe it's moderate left. Maybe I'm thinking from a U.S. perspective there, but you know, there was a lot of promises inside of that campaign. The approval rating has just dissipated massively, right? So give us some context of what was delivered out there. I mean, we're all used to empty campaign promises, but what was actually promised, and why the rapid disappointment, the disapproval, as Sam kind of pointed out, just skyrocketed.
Well, Boric's personal approval has not really fallen. He's still roughly at 50%. The convention is more unpopular, I suspect, because people are feeling that the convention is not really addressing the issues that people were hoping would be fixed. So I think that's where that's that logic. Boric is still very popular. He represents more than extreme left. He represents a generational shift. So again, I've said this in several interviews, where the issues that he brings to the fore aren't, you know, the traditional left was basically based on class differences, right? And the rich versus the poor, and the workers versus the capitalists.
Capital, right?
Boric's worldview has more to do with the things that are, for example, that I mentioned, the convention. It's all about feminism, environmentalism. He talks about having a feminist foreign policy. It's about ensuring that underrepresented groups get their share and their say. And
it's a great ideology.
And,
right?
You know, and it speaks to the demands that, you know, so many people in Chile have not felt represented for so long. So, but at the same time, just to kind of place Boric on the ideological spectrum, he's been very critical of Cuba and Venezuela, Nicaragua, and he's been very critical of Putin's actions in Ukraine. So he's not kind of the traditional far left that we've seen in Latin America over the last 50 years. Having said that, he has made a lot of promises, and he has made a lot of promises that sound like they come from the left, especially from an American point of view, which is, you know, increased social services, better healthcare, better education, public, everything public.
Yeah.
But really, when you look at it in detail, what he's proposing is something much more. And he's been quite explicit in this, that his model is kind of a European social democratic model, you know, or Canada or New Zealand. And that, you know, that is not a far left thing, especially in the Latin American context. In the Latin American context for generations, social democracy was seen as kind of wishy-washy. So he's kind of dresses, and he's dressed that up in a more, I guess, revolutionary look, even the way he dresses himself, you know, his refusal to wear a tie and things like that. But really, when you look at his policies, it's not that radical. The question is, of course, whether Chile has the means to pay for all of this. And that's where the long list of promises eventually is going to run up against the wall.
Yeah. And well, that's always with the social aspects, is that how does it get paid for, right? And I think at least in the US, we always say, well, we're just going to grow, right? It's growth can do that. And we know that there's been challenges in the currency market. The Chilean peso has really gotten kind of smacked, you know, over the last couple of years during this. And so, you know, one of the big things, again, knowing our client base too down here, is the pension system. So what are some of the proposals out there on the, what we call the AFP system down here? What are some of the implications that you see with this pension system, which, you know, Chileans pay significantly into, right?
Sure. Well, it's interesting what you mentioned about the peso, because as you rightly say, after the protests in late 2019, the peso dropped quite substantially versus the dollar. Today, it's actually at a fairly, you know, it's returned to a kind of range, which is fairly reasonable, below 800 pesos to the dollar, which is really interesting because you wonder, you know, how much the markets are taking into account the risk that is really there. Part of that is being offset by interest rates and actions of the central bank, and part of it is being upset by the price of copper. But, you know, there's a question as to whether the peso is really reflecting the level of risk that we have going forward. And maybe it does. Maybe the markets understand that really is, you know, there's nothing that crazy going on. We're going through a kind of adjustment period, but in the end, things will be fine. We'll see. Regarding pensions, you know, the AFP system, of course, you know, Chile was a pioneer in setting up the private pension system, you know, personal pension accounts and so on. The problem with the pensions, and the reason that Chile did that when it did, which was during the dictatorship, was that one of the historic problems of all Latin American countries was that we didn't have domestic capital markets. And Chile, after the Allende experience and during the dictatorship, certainly did not have a domestic capital market. So they set up a system that had two purposes. One was to create a domestic capital market, and the second was to provide pension. In the first objective, it succeeded fantastically. In the second objective, it failed miserably. So when you
have on average, it was okay. On average, well,
except the thing is a pension system. So what happened was, of course, people didn't really start taking out their pensions until only a few years ago. They paid in for 30 years,
right?
And now suddenly they're taking out, and they realize they get $200 a month, $300 a month. And Chile is not a cheap country, and increasingly less so. So that's kind of led to the realization that we needed to do something about the pension system. And the question, of course, is what? And the proposal from the left has always been to just destroy the AFP system and replace it with a European style, public system. And Boric's proposal seems to be more of a mix. He hasn't been very big on details, but it seems to be more of a mixed system where that eventually we will transit towards a public system, but there will be the possibility, they won't touch the existing savings. So they're not going to nationalize the savings that people have in private pensions, but eventually going forward, we're going to start paying into a public system, and you will have the option to then have private pensions on top of that. So they're not really getting rid of the private system. They're probably going to get rid of things called AFPs because they have a marketing problem, just like the Constitution. You can't call it, you have to change it because they have a legitimacy problem.
It's like our trade agreement. We didn't like NAFTA, so right. We created USMC because right. You had to put US first, right? Because that's what it was. But it's right. Like it's roughly the same deal, right?
So if things go well, we'll probably end up with a mixed system. The existing AFP system will be smaller because obviously people will start paying into the public system. But those who can afford it will then continue with a kind of private system, I would imagine. Less clear is the healthcare system, where I think they really want to go to a fully public system.
Like a single payer type of system that we continually talk about in the US, but we can't get there either. So what are the implications of this moving to a public system versus the privatization? Because you're saying potentially it's not national. You just kind of have a dual system until everybody converts over to the public system. Is there financial market risk within that?
Well, I guess the implications are, and again, I'm not a huge expert on that, but in terms of public policy, the implications are on the face of it there's an impact on capital markets. Now, it depends on how even the public system will be run. I mean, I grew up in Canada, right? And the Canadian system is public, but it's run by it's run by a separate board and invested in the private market. The Ontario Teachers Pension Fund is a great example. I know they have a lot of investments here in Chile. So if it's run well, and if it's run independently from political considerations, then there shouldn't be that much of an impact on capital markets. That's a big if.
Yeah, it's a big theoretical exercise.
It could be. We'll see.
Yeah.
As you talk about the impact on capital markets, I know one of the things that Chile has been working towards, and it's in motion now, is just the idea of nationalization and royalties around Chilean resources, the mining of copper, lithium, gold, perhaps forestry. What do you expect to come out of this these reforms, and what will be some of the financial and economic impacts if they do go through as proposed?
So I think we have to separate nationalization from royalties, right? I mean, there is talk of nationalization. So let me go back to the constitutional process. The way that articles are being approved or proposed is that there are 9 different committees, the way that you have committees in Congress, and they look at things like the political system and the economic system and so on, the environment. And so in order for articles to come out of committee, they need to be approved by 50% of the votes in those committees. And some of those committees have, the political makeup is more tilted to the left than other committees. So for example, the environmental committee is more tilted to the left, and they have proposed things like nationalizing mining and forestry. Now, about 2 weeks ago, the environmental committee sent 40 articles or proposals to the plenary for approval. The plenary approved one. So
that, that's better than we do in the US right now.
to committee. Committee then renegotiates, reworks them, and sends them back to committee to the plenary for a vote. And if it's rejected a second time, then it's done. It does not go into the Constitution. And one of the risks actually of the Constitution is we're going to have a lot of gaps because we're not going to have agreement on these things. So what I'm getting at is that talk of nationalization, it's true, there is talk of nationalization, but it's unlikely because it needs to get through these hurdles. I fear that some things may make their way through because of the nature of politics. I suspect that nationalization won't. I can't guarantee that it won't. I suspect that it won't. And I suspect that nationalization would be, and if it does make it into the text, nationalization will be one of those things where it would really be a red light for a lot of people when they have to vote to approve or disapprove the constitutional text in a referendum 6 months from now. Now, royalties are different. Royalties, I think, definitely will be part of the discussion. I mean, the kind of a consensus that Chile needs to, the Chilean state needs to grow, we need to protect our environment and all these things that royalties play into. And that I think we're going to see in copper. And of course, we're going to have a very interesting discussion on lithium because there's a discussion on what kind of structure we should have if we should build something like a Codelco, a national mining company for lithium, which at the moment doesn't exist.
Well, and I think the popularity of lithium with the decarbonization, the electrification of cars is something that's really a hot topic as well. One other thing that, you know, talking to my emerging markets team back in LA, they were talking about, you know, the ambitious goals of the new finance minister, which I think is Mario Marcel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that essentially that there's going to be this fiscal consolidation, or in their viewpoint, that's the way the market's treating it. And that the goal is to get the deficit down significantly to about 1% of GDP, which I'd love to have that in America, first of all. I guess I should say the U.S. because we are in America down here, right? So it's funny. It's a very U.S. thing to say. It's America. We're all Americans here. But, you know, that would be like a massive cut to fiscal expenditures. So is that possible, one, in your viewpoint? And secondly, like, how do you hack 20% of the government budget?
One of the really interesting things, and it goes back to what we were saying about Gabriel Boric a while ago, that, you know, he's not the traditional left, because one of the things that he emphasizes, and this is very Chilean, is he emphasizes fiscal responsibility. You know, I mean, in Argentina, you know, the left, it would, you know, would die with the kind of emphasis on fiscal responsibility that we have here. And Marcel certainly is going to be the guy that needs to put the brake on things and say, you know, we need to watch the bottom line. The question is how you do that, right? And of course, they want to increase spending. They want to increase services. They say that some of that's going to come from efficiencies and avoiding tax evasion. Well, you know, all governments say
that. Sounds great.
All governments say that. And then they see, you know, the tax on the super rich and things like that, and the estimates that they make on how much you can actually raise from taxing the super rich is probably twice, two or three times what you can actually raise. Their way of ensuring that we exercise fiscal responsibility is focused more on taxes, I think, than on cutting. But they're probably severely overestimating how much they're going to be able to raise with some of the proposals that they have. And if they want to stick to fiscal responsibility, that means limiting, of course, maybe not how far they can go, but how quickly they can go. What's really interesting is that Boric, on election, not on election night, the night that he was inaugurated, he gave a speech from the Moneda presidential palace, the balcony, and he said,
it's a beautiful building, by the way.
Beautiful building. Yeah. And he says, we're going to go slowly because we want to go far. And what's interesting about that is that he's basically recognizing that he needs to manage expectations. Mm. There's huge expectations on him, and this is going to eventually reflect on obviously on popularity. People are expecting results now. The same is true for the Constitution. You know, when you ask Chileans what they expect from the new Constitution, they say better healthcare, better pensions, and better education. And constitutions don't often do that. So Boric understands that he needs to manage expectations. And part of that is going to go through how much they manage to raise, which may not be as much as they hope.
So, Dr. Funk, I wanted to bring back to something that you said earlier. You used the term public discontent, you know, when talking about the 2019 Chilean protests that I believe lasted through 2021 even. Protests around that time, that time period, were not unique to Chile. I think, to at least just off the top of my head, the protests that occurred in Hong Kong around that time, there were protests here in the U.S. That really culminated in 2020, but based on, you know, some root underlying causes. And I know the causes themselves are probably unique to these various countries, but are there, do you see any commonalities in terms of the root underlying cause or catalyst for some of these protests that really took place around the world, at least geographically around the world? I'm not saying that every country had it, but, you know, it just seems like there's fire, you know, there's literal fires going around, you know, different hotspots around the world, led by, you know, the younger generation, as you've talked about.
So you mentioned that the protests lasted until 2021. My feeling is that the protest, what we call in Spanish, we call the estallido social, which it translates into social explosion. My feeling is that it never really ended. We're still in it. The only thing, what basically happened was that COVID happened. And so protests, you know, first they were, you know, every day, and then they ended up being every Friday, and there were fewer people attending. By the southern Chilean summer of 2020, February of 2020, there were basically much fewer people every Friday getting together for a barbecue in the central square of Santiago. And then came COVID, and the thing kind of died out. But the demands and the pressure and the anger and the discontent didn't necessarily go away. They, you know, I think the constitutional process quite smartly did what it was supposed to do, which was to channel a lot of that energy into a political process rather than to have it on the street. But the energy and the anger is still there. And whether that energy and that anger is similar to events in other parts of the world, you know, we've been having this conversation or asking the question since the protests of 2011. I mentioned that we had massive student protests in 2011. Well, what else did we have in 2011? We had Occupy Wall Street, we had the Arab Spring, we had the Indignados in Madrid. Everything was happening in 2011, and people were asking, are these things connected? And they're not really, except that I think there is in the age of instant communication, you have, you know, a kid watching Twitter, reading Twitter, and seeing, hey, this is happening there, why can't we kind of protest against the injustices that we feel? So there's that. But you know, the root causes of the protests in Egypt in the Arab Spring are very, very different from what Occupy Wall Street was or what the Chilean protests were in Chile. Except the feeling, and this is where I think they have in common with 2011 and also 2019, the feeling that governments are not responding, the feeling that people are not feeling represented, that they're responding to corporate interests or to they're more interested in getting reelected rather than answering to the people. I think that's common in every case. And it's a really interesting question. And that's why I think so many people are looking at the Chilean experience, because in that sense, writing a new constitution for all its problems is the best answer to that particular feeling, right? If you're not feeling represented, and that's why there's so much emphasis on representation in the constitutional convention. The problem, of course, is that representation is only one part of the political game. You also have to have stability, you have to have governability. And, you know, the founding fathers of the United, I'm getting very, very kind of political sciencey here, but the founding fathers of the United States understood perfectly, especially Madison, the Federalist Papers and so on, the trade-off that you have between representation and stability. That's why you guys have an electoral college. That's why you have a Senate. In Chile now, they're talking about getting rid of the Senate. So there's a trade-off there. We're trying to find that sweet spot. And I suspect that many other societies, as this thing works its way through, are also going to be looking for that new balance, or to recalibrate the balance between representation, governability, political growth, political stability, and so on.
So on that note too, I think where probably Sam is pulling some of his commonalities too is you mentioned corporate interests, but we also have, you know, that it feels like the wealthy tend to be more represented by the governments, so especially in the democracies around the world. And so, you know, I like to remind people that the US isn't a democracy, it's actually a republic. You know, if you get into the political science definition, sure. The key distinctions, but, you know, ultimately though, you talk about bringing the stability back in. And so is this good for the outlook of growth in Chile? Does it continue to cloud it? And, you know, how are you thinking about, you know, in terms of, you know, foreign investment coming in, just, you know, capital markets functioning? How do you think about, you know, this new regime and this new government? Does it muddy the water in the near term, or is this really a good opportunity for investors? And again, the Chilean society as a whole. Mm-hmm. It's a lot in there, I know.
Yeah. I think both things are true. Certainly we're going through a period, and we're going to remain in a period with quite a lot of uncertainty, and the markets don't like uncertainty. We don't know what's going to come out of the Constitutional Convention. We don't know how much of Boric's reform agenda will actually be approved. We don't know what that's going to look like. Things that really affect the markets are obviously the changes to the AFP, but also things in the convention, like, for example, environmental protection, you know, the way that they're talking about indigenous rights over their land, over water. Well, how's that going to affect, for example, the forestry industry? So there's a lot of uncertainty, and but uncertainty eventually will get certain.
Yeah, you know, right.
Eventually we'll know. Yeah. And the markets will always be able to adjust to, you know, I remember speaking to some clients once of a bank. And they said, you know, we still operate in Venezuela. You know, once we know what the situation is, we adjust to the situation. But that could
sounds like Deutsche Bank.
But that could take a while. Yeah. But that could take a while.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the costs can be large. Yeah. The positive side is, though, that, you know, this is not a government that is anti-market per se. It can sound like it, but I think it's a government that really wants us and to rethink what the market is about. And I go back to the issue of the woke constitution, you know. It's not, this is a new kind of left that by no means wants people to stop spending or going to the mall or traveling to, you know, New York. But it's a new generation. Boric is 36 years old. Most of the ministers are around 40. That understand that if the world keeps operating the way that it's been operating, we're either going to burn or go broke, or, you know, or people will starve, or Chile has a water problem, has serious problems in terms of access to water, and that's only going to get worse. So the market, you know, the new economy needs to adjust to that, and that in itself will create opportunities. There's a lot of things happening in Chile with regard to green energy. So I think that what they're hoping for is not that they're going to be anti-market, but there's going to be a shift in the emphasis of how we do things. And that may mean, for example, more taxes on mining, that sort of thing. And looking for new opportunities that, you know, I think Chile can be very, very competitive on. I'll give you one example. You know, we have relied for so long on copper exports or mineral exports, on pulp and paper, on fishing, on fruit and wine, right? That's kind of what we sell to the world. Well, what happens if the rest of the world wakes up one day and says, you know, what's the carbon footprint on this wine I'm drinking in LA that comes from Chile? And we're going to tax that carbon footprint. So it's not a bad idea for Chile to start thinking now about how to adjust to that before we're suddenly left out in the cold, because everything that we're selling in the world has a 50% markup because of the carbon footprint.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have one last follow-up on that too. First of all, we don't get a lot of access to Chilean wines because of just in California, there's too much there. Now it is great. It is excellent. I always enjoy it when I'm down here. But you brought up this kind of green revolution and, you know, thinking about how that it kind of portends for the future. And so is this something, like, if I look at like the conflict with Ukraine and Russia right now, right? And you know, again, we don't have to get into what's going on specifically there, but just the amount of damage it's done to the commodity side of the equation, right? And so does this help accelerate, you know, events such as that accelerate the green revolution, or does it just show our utter reliance on, you know, the old carbon world?
I'm not an expert, but I know a little bit of history. And you look at the oil crisis in the 1970s in the United States, all over the world, but particularly in the United States, right? What happened with the oil crisis? The price of oil jumped like crazy. I think it was more expensive in relative terms than even what it is now. Yeah. Americans were used to driving huge, you know, Chryslers and Fords and things. And a few years later, they were buying Volkswagens and Toyotas. And cars got lighter and they got more efficient and life went on. So I suspect that that's kind of a blueprint for how we're going to the, you know, the reality, if things get more expensive, either because of the war in Ukraine or because of supply and demand or because of taxes here in Chile, you adjust to the new reality. And, you know, it is a good question to ask ourselves how sustainable it is to rely for another 100 years on just taking rocks out of the ground and selling them abroad. So if we're forced to innovate, that's a good thing. And probably most innovation actually comes the way that happened in the oil crisis. Most innovation comes from necessity. It doesn't come from when things are hunky-dory and there's no reason to change.
So, you know, Dr. Funk, we've talked about some of the ambitious plans, you know, that President Boric has for reform, and we've talked about balancing the needs for, you know, the higher costs versus where's the money going to come from for the revenue. So this is all on top of this backdrop of an already challenging economic, you know, a backdrop basically that the President Boric has inherited. You know, we could talk about the higher, you know, the high level of inflation, perhaps a slowing economy, relatively high levels of unemployment. But if you're to put on your, you know, if you're to look in your crystal ball, what would be your outlook for the Chilean economy under the Boric administration for the next 4 years? Crystal ball is always everyone's favorite time, but figured I'll throw it out there.
I think it's hard to think of 4 years, especially given sort of the geopolitical situation. It's very, very hard. The next year is going to be tough. We know Chile grew at a ridiculous rate last year because of government transfers, because of the withdrawal of the AFP savings, which led to a consumer boom. That's not sustainable. So, you know, it was something like 11% or something last year, and we're going to, you know, from dropping from 11% to 2% or 1% sounds like a, you know, a crash. So we're going to feel that. Employment has felt it yet. I think employment is still relatively, has recovered substantially from the pandemic. But the other thing to keep in mind, of course, is that the economic impact that Chile has, or the economic effects that Chile is still emerging from, are not only the effects of the pandemic, but also the effects of the protests of 2019. So we had a double whammy. I like to joke that, you know, when everybody was buying toilet paper when the pandemic started, I had tons of toilet paper because I bought it 4 months earlier after the protest.
You know, it's funny about that. Just a completely tangent on that is that we accidentally got like a triple order from Amazon on it. And so I actually had all this toilet paper and I'm like, what are we going to do with this? In fact, I traded with some of our colleagues. I was trying to get eggs. We call it my trading outpost, because we were actually trading true commodities at that point in time. And I wasn't trying to hoard. Right. It was just, we made an error in the Amazon order.
Well, hopefully we won't get to that in Chile. Yeah. But so I think next year is going to be very, very tough. And on top of that, there is, as I said, the uncertainty surrounding the constitutional convention. To me, I don't think the Boric government and his reform agenda offer a great deal of uncertainty. We know what they want to do. We know that they're fairly responsible. We know they have a good finance minister. I think they're going to have political problems like crazy. The issue with the Mapuches in the south, the issue with immigration in the north, managing his own internal coalition. Politically, there's something I haven't mentioned, which I think is really important here. One of the aspects of the constitutional amendment, which made possible this whole constitutional process, says that if the new political system is changed substantially, the word is substantially, in other words, if they change the executive, which they are, which are going to do, the proposal is to have a president, a vice president, and something called a head of government, similar to a kind of prime minister. And if Congress changes substantially, if the legislative branch changes substantially, which, and they're probably going to do that, getting rid of the Senate and replacing it with something else, then that opens the door to the possibility of calling for new elections. So it is possible to add to all the uncertainty we've already said, it is possible that before the end of Boric's term, even as early as next year, we might have elections again. So, you know, the political uncertainty is, I think, much greater. The constitutional uncertainty is much greater than, I think, anything that Boric might be proposing or to do or not to do. And I think that is going to have an impact on growth, certainly in a year, over the next year, over the next 2 years. Beyond that, it's very hard to see. I mean, if oil, you know, goes crazy, that's a further pressure on the Chilean economy. Chile relies entirely on imports for its energy, at least for oil and gas.
Well, Dr. Funk, we really appreciate you taking the time and spending it with us today. I love Santiago, Chile. It's one of my favorite cities, actually, in the world. It's wonderful people. And, you know, we wish you well with all the reforms that's going on. And we're always happy to come down here. So it's great to just be able to pick someone's mind in these truly uncertain times. And we've been talking about geopolitical risk. And, you know, it's always it seems to be focused a lot on the Ukraine war. And people don't realize all of the geopolitical risk within the Latin American region. Right. And so we'd love to have you back some other time. Give us updates. And we really appreciate the time. However, there's one part of the show that we have to do that's Sam's favorite part. Before we let you leave. So Sam, take it away.
All right, Dr. Funk, and that favorite part of the show is called Sherman Said. Where I will offer a series of alternating prompts between you and Sherman, to which I hope to get a concise but interesting top of mind response. So to give you the first example here, I'm going to throw out the first prompt to Sherman with U.S. Constitution.
It's a very strong document when you think about it. Having this conversation reminds me just how, you know, like, as he said, with Madison, the Federalist Papers, the foresight it was and the generalities, and, you know, no one else in the world has anything similar to it. So kudos to those gentlemen that put it together. And kudos for us to kind of continue to follow it.
All right. And the next one is to you, Dr. Funk, with 30 pesos.
Well, of course, the slogan was, it wasn't 30 pesos was the 5 cents that we talked about. And the slogan became, it's not 30 pesos, it's 30 years. And and I disagree completely with that. I think the last 30 years are the best 30 years in the history of Chile. And I understand the need for change, but I also worry that we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
All right. For you, Sherman, work from home uniform.
It's completely different than what I'm wearing today. We actually have a tie on, Sam, something you haven't seen from me in a long time. So my work from home uniform is business on top and party on the bottom. We live in LA. It's a lot of shorts with a dress shirt.
Yeah, I was going to say, our listeners can't see you today, but it's not just the tie, but you have a dark suit and a plain white shirt to go with it. So it's totally business on top. I hope it's not party down below right now.
No, I'll stand up for you. There you go. So there is, it is a fresh suit.
All right, looking good. Okay, you know, since we had fun with that one, Dr. Funk, I'm going to throw that same question to you, or prompt to you, work from home uniform.
I miss it.
All right, that's a great response. Back to you,
Sherman. And also to our listeners out here, Sam thought we were recording audio, which we are. I thought it was video. So he goes, hold on, I've got to go put on a shirt. And we're like, what? You're not even wearing a shirt when you do this? That's risky in the world of Zoom and everything to not wear it. So Dr. Funk did thank you for putting on a shirt. So.
Yes, he did. And I will put the backdrop here. It's gotten, it seems like summer's come early here in LA. I mean, I think we're around 87 today. So it hit, at least where I'm at in that part of LA, it's forecast to hit up to 87. So I'm preparing. Thinking ahead, stay ready so I don't have to get ready, Sherman.
Yeah, you know, that's my favorite saying.
All right, so let's get back on track here with the one for Sherman is London Metals Exchange.
Biggest crooks in the history of financial markets. Again, I still don't understand why they're in business. I don't understand this now limit up thing. Somehow, you know, Big Shot got his trades cleared, but we can't trade. The biggest thing that kills me about all of this is that the market functions throughout the day, the trading window, whether that's 5 minutes or not, trades are done, the market limits up, and every trade that day is canceled. How is that price discovery? How is that a free market? And so I'm making one more plea to the CME. CME, start listing all of the other metals. Let's get this business away from the crooks at the London Metal Exchange. I have a very strong opinion, Sam, as you can see.
That's, you held it in check.
I know we have compliance listening. So you know my real response on the trading desk. And if those of you that don't get access to our trading desk, you can just go on to Cliff Assens's Twitter account, and it's on par with what Cliff's saying.
Here, here. All right, Dr. Funk, fossil fuel independence.
Wow. Not sure it's possible. Don't know. Not sure it's possible. I guess it depends for who. You guys are in better shape than we are. But it's become increasingly clear that the politics of fossil fuels is really screwing up the world.
Literally. Yeah, truly. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, why can't we have multiple systems? Like, you know, the people who are so pro fossil fuels are like, oh, it's expensive, all this other stuff. But like, why can't we have wind and hydro and solar and some fossil fuels?
Well, you know, I invite you to have a look at what Chile's done. I mean, Chile, as I said, is very dependent on import, completely dependent on imports of oil and gas. But in terms of energy, over the last 8 years or so, starting with the second government of Michelle Bachelet, we really have had a revolution in terms of building alternative fuel source, not fuel source, energy sources, wind, especially wind and solar, a little bit on ocean, but not so much, but wind and solar, we've made great progress. So absolutely, and it can be a mix, and I think in many places it is a mix.
All right. Sherman, two-party system. This is in contrast to what I read, and you know, Dr. Funk, please correct me if I'm wrong, that Chile has a 26th political party system.
Could be. We don't have 26 parties in Congress, but it's increased substantially over the last 10 years.
Yeah, I feel like the two-party system is a relic. You know, that I think that's what creates some of this divisiveness, is that there's a lot of people who want to be independent, right? But because they don't agree with either of our political parties in the US. And I think that's evidenced by a lot of our elections, that our elections are ran as anybody but incumbent, right? And so I guess maybe that's happening in a lot of places. But what is it? Is it like Belgium too, that has like 13 different little regions inside of there, and they have to get this majority? I mean, so two party sounds horrible because we don't agree with them all the time. But, you know, how you get to this 26, I don't know, it's mind-boggling.
Well, you know, one of the problems in the world, not just in the States, is that the party system needs to reflect what in political science we call cleavages, right, in society. So if, as long as the cleavage was left and right,
yeah,
then two parties makes, we have kind of something more or less on the right, something more or less on the left, and over time it kind of shifts a little bit within those spaces. But if the cleavages get more complicated and you have people on the right who are pro-environment, people on the left who are anti-immigration, and all the mixes in between, then it becomes very difficult for two parties or even five parties to really represent different positions. And part of, I spoke earlier about the issue of representation. Part of the reason that people don't feel represented, I think, is because they themselves don't really understand what representation means. So they say, you know, if I don't feel represented because I'm a woman and there aren't enough women in Congress. So that's one kind of representation, but maybe, you know, a man represents other aspects of my political identity or my identity as a person, whatever. So it's very hard today for political parties to really fulfill that role. And it's even harder if there's only two parties.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I guess that's why we have so many factions within our two-party system. Back to you, Dr. Funk, with political elite.
Must be permeable. You're always going to have elites. There's a lot of literature on, you know, there's all kinds of elites. And I once told my students that they were an elite because they study at the University of Chile, and they say, oh no, professor, we're not an elite, but they are. They're at least they're an academic elite. But and the good thing about that kind of elite, of course, is that it's permeable. You do well in school, you join that kind of elite. Where society is getting into trouble is when elites are not, there's no way to get into them, which is kind of what Chile has a lot of that too, right? So you can do really well in school. If you come from a kind of lower middle class background, best in your class, study at the University of Chile, top of your, and then you want to join a, you know, top law firm or a top board, and they'll say, well, who is your father? What's your last name? What school did you study at? Then that's a problem. The States has done a much better job, or used to do a much better job of that, of course, than many societies in Latin America. So there's nothing wrong with elites as long as there are clear paths to entering them.
Great response. Okay, last one for each of you. Sherman, yours is going to be, and apologies if I butcher this, but a aquí está Coco. Favorite Chilean food or drink?
Actually, that was dinner last night. So we ate there last night. It's a phenomenal restaurant.
I've been there years.
Yeah, the seafood is just to die for. And so excellent.
We should have recorded this there.
Yeah, next time we will. And by the way, it pairs very nicely with some local Chilean wine. So it was excellent, and I highly recommend it to anybody who comes to Santiago.
All right. And hat tip to Joe Pena for that one, who may or may not be in the room. But if he's not in the room, then we'll see if he actually listens to the Sherman Show. Joe,
he's not in the room, so we're going to find out.
All right, Joe, let me know when you hear this. All right. And then the last one to wrap this all up, bring us home, Dr. Funk, with your must eat when visiting the United States.
Oh, when visiting the United States, I thought you were going to say here.
I was going to say America, but then Sherman pointed out that is a very U.S.-centric thing.
The list is huge. The list is huge. What do I must eat when I visit the United States?
Top three.
Top three. One is Five Guys.
Burgers.
One is... normally red licorice, which we do not have here.
red vines? Just the licorice. Okay.
And probably I'd say bagels.
Okay.
All right.
I could say Edmunds.
Well, thank you for the time today. Dr. Funk, you know, for our listeners out there, how can they get in touch with you, follow you, listen to some of your content?
Well, my Twitter handle is Funk of Chile, and that's normally where I communicate to the world, and the world tells me I'm wrong. And of course, you can communicate, get in touch with me through there, or through the University of Chile, or the Andes Risk Group website.
Okay, perfect.
AndesRiskGroup.cl.
All right, so that has been the first Sherman Show recording from Santiago, Chile. We were very pleased to have our guest today, Dr. Funk. You can catch all of our episodes on our website. You can get these on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play. I think it's called Google Play still. A bunch of players I don't know about. Wherever podcasts are at, we probably have one. If not, send us an email. At Sherman Show Pod is the Twitter handle. The email is shermanshow@doubleline.com. There's no pod on that one. The Twitter is @ShermanShowPod. And don't forget, Funk of Chile. I love the handle.
A global source partner, of course, for who set this up. So yes, thanks to them.
Yes, thank you to them. So that's a wrap, everyone. We'll come at you again in about 2 weeks' time. So look forward to our next episode. Thank you.
Represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.